From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's been a year, 52 weeks since the city of Los Angeles saw its first COVID-19 fatality. And this week marks 52 weeks since the first shutdown, when restaurants, bars, gyms, and schools closed their doors, not knowing what was to come or when they would reopen. There has been no single pandemic year for everyone. For some, it was an opportunity to hunker down and get to Reno family. For others, it's been an intensely lonely experience, rife with mental health issues. And yet for others, lack of employment, rent pressure, or both, meant a year filled with tremendous anxiety and insecurity. For parents who have been working from home, it's been a desperate circus balancing act. And of course, for all too many, there has been the loss of someone dear and irreplaceable, in addition to all the other pressures. Someone who couldn't be held or comforted, the cruelest of COVID's jabs. For me, an introvert with a job and somewhere stable to live, this has been a time of recognizing my privilege and of doubling down on the work I do in partnership with Julian Ferguson and Laurel Garcia, the producers of Good Food. God, I appreciate them so much. I weep more easily and more often, a result, I think, of the inability to communally mourn the loss of life that our country has experienced over the past year. And my relationship to food is changed forever. So many friends and listeners took care of me when I elected not to leave the house for months. Those meals and snacks were pure expressions of caring and reaching out in one of the few ways we could. No matter how you have experienced this past year, no doubt your view of the world has been transformed. Today on the show, we share stories of transformation from people across the food sphere, starting with LA native Hugh Augustine, a musician and rapper turned vegan chef. His story is a full 180 that could only have happened in 2020. I'll let him tell you the details.
Yo, it's Hugh Augustine. I represent the Leimert Park community of Los Angeles. I'm a local artist, entrepreneur, and vegan chef. Before COVID-19 pandemic, I was working diligently in the studio every day, making an album, and I was getting ready to hit the road on a 20-city national tour to promote that album. Like my spirit's untouchable. In the club, I'm unrushable. I ain't trying to play with these boys, they eat lunchables. Only way to grow is if you get uncomfortable. Living in the city, some bullets unduckable. That ain't my... The day that I heard we were shutting down for COVID and I was no longer going to be able to go on tour, I was pretty devastated. I didn't really know what I was going to be doing in my day to day. But at the same time, I knew that I was going to be home a lot and I knew I was going to need to cook. And I grew up with my mother running a catering business. So I always was cooking in the kitchen from a very young age, and it's kind of been my secret talent ever since I could remember. And I always enjoyed cooking and learning recipes from my mom. So with all that extra free time during the pandemic, I figured, you know, let's start cooking. Let's get better at these vegan recipes, and let's start trying some new stuff as well. So that's the way that my new venture was born. I figured that there was, you know, people in my community that were looking for some healthy, affordable options during the pandemic. And why not be the person to provide that to the community? I've been vegan now for 2.5, almost 3 years. And originally, I became vegan as a way to be preventative about my health care. You know, we have so many underlying health problems in the community, and a lot of them come from our lifestyle choices. And so I just wanted to do something preventative about that. The older I get, the more susceptible I'm becoming to those types of illnesses, like diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol. And that's something that's plaguing the community right now. So, you know, I just wanted to be as preventative as possible with my healthcare. And I know the best way to do that is to start with the food. I come from the Leimert Park, Baldwin Hills community of Los Angeles. We're a predominantly African-American community. The community is rich with culture, art, music, so much history of why people are drawn to Los Angeles comes from my neighborhood. You know, we've been the home to many African-American singers, songwriters, movie stars, directors. It's a really special place with a lot of creative energy. I totally see what I'm doing with the cooking as a form of activism. Where I live, it's known as a food desert, right? And so what a food desert is a place that lacks healthy, nutritious food that is also affordable to the people in the community. Versus, you know, when you think about Los Angeles and the different neighborhoods, a place like Brentwood or Beverly Hills, where there's organic farmer markets, there's, you know, different chains that have a higher quality of organic selections and produce. There's a bigger focus on farm to table in those establishments. Where I live, even chains that are in my community that also exist in other communities in LA, we have a lower quality of food that's coming into our grocery stores with less options. It's almost ridiculous to me that we don't have these necessities, these basic needs, but I am grateful to be in a position to provide some type of help in that way. My mom was really proud when she saw that I was written up in the LA Times. And I think it was almost like a passing of the baton or carrying on the torch in a way. My dad was in the music business. And so a lot of the time growing up doing music, it was almost like I was taking after my dad. And so now that I'm in the food industry, it's like I'm taking after my mom. And so she's very proud of the progress that I've made and the mission that I'm on. Hughes Hot Bowls is available every Friday in Leimert Park in front of the Regency West. That's on 43rd between Degnan and Creed. And so every week we have a rotating menu. Last week I made our Soul Bowl. And so we're pretty popular for the Soul Bowl. What comes in that is red beans and rice, clean greens, mac and cheese, candied yams, and a vegan cornbread muffin. And I really enjoy making that meal because it's the vegan version of something that we had in the house all the time for holidays, and something that really, you know, makes me feel connected to my family, to my grandmother, you know, our history in coming to LA.
I be low-key, but I'm really with the extras. Moving top speed like somebody trying to catch us. If I wild out, ain't nobody gonna protect ya. If I wild out,
That's Hugh Augustine. Every Friday, he's dishing out Hugh's Hot Bowls in Leimert Park. We've got details on how to pre-order on our website. Coming up, two extraordinary immigrant women, one home cook and one restaurateur. They share their pandemic stories next. Welcome back to Good Food. Years ago, when I first became aware of League of Kitchens, I likened them to female superheroes. This New York-based group of home cooks come from all over the world: Afghanistan, Nepal, Uzbekistan, Iraq. They welcome students into their homes for deep learning. Yes, recipes, but even more so about their lives. Lisa Gross founded the League and has watched as lives change when her group of teachers form relationships through the classes. Much like everything else in our lives, teaching changed by necessity, from an in-person home-based encounter to a Zoom experience. Lisa joins us with cooking instructor Mab Abbas Golizadeh from Iran to talk about the past year.
So before the pandemic, we were hosting intimate cooking workshops in our instructors' homes, 6 students max, 4.5 hour classes, strangers gathering in a stranger's home to cook and eat together in a small New York City apartment. So in every way, that is intentionally not a socially distant experience. You know, everything shut down in New York City mid-March, earlier obviously than many other parts of the country. We had 6 weeks of sold out classes that I pretty quickly canceled because I just realized this is not going to work. What we do is not safe during the pandemic. And then probably late March, actually right after my husband got COVID, he got sick around March 20th and thankfully is fine, was fine, but got very sick and was quarantining in our bedroom for 18 days while I was actually alone with our 2 daughters who were 3 and almost 6 at the time, which was also very insane. And so at some point in early April, I read an article that said this could last for a year, maybe 2 years. And I realized that we had to move online. Otherwise, we would go out of business. We would have to shut down. The idea of starting online classes just made me shudder and dread for many reasons initially. One was that I was worried it would just be the shadow of the real life experience. And 2, I had a lot of dread training our instructors, who are all older immigrant women, to use all of this technology and to train them remotely. And, you know, none of them had ever done, taken an online class, taught an online class. This is like a whole new universe. I actually took 7 online cooking classes at different cooking schools around the country to just learn about what this is. How does this work? What are people doing well? What could we do differently? What could we do better? And then in April, just very quickly started to design a new structure for online classes. And one of the first 2 instructors I reached out to was Mab. And one of the reasons I did that was because she is a documentary filmmaker. She's been a digital activist and activist for many years in Iran and is an amazing teacher. And I just felt like she would be able to do this. So Mab, in the very beginning of the pandemic, I called you and, you know, you were having a lot of feelings. You were having a lot of experiences connecting to your own history in Iran. I think at that time, you weren't quite ready to teach online classes. I wasn't even sure if we should do online classes. What was it like for you in those early weeks of the pandemic?
Even thinking about that time, it's like thinking about the another world, because it was like a dead city. Everything was shutting down, like our workshops, my job, schools, and it was for me huge trigger about war in Iran or about the very hard life when I was in, because of my activism, I was in jail and I was struggling in anxiety. And the only things for me was finding refuge in my home. And I started to connect with my mom and my sisters and my aunt. I always wanted to learn about very difficult recipes of my mom and my aunt, like a dolme and cuckoo and aloo morg. I asked my aunt to, okay, please, please, every night I called her.
And they're in Iran, right?
Yeah, I call her from New York and say, hey, Khalehuri, make a dolme and show me that, how you are doing it. It was fun for both of us that she's talking about the story and cooking and showing me different type of food from Azerbaijan, because we are from Azerbaijan, Iran. And then after that, I started connect with my mom. I said, oh, that is fun that I can ask them to show me by FaceTime about how they cook foods that I really always was curious to know how is it, and I didn't have time before.
So do you feel like through this experience of cooking with your mom and your aunt and your sisters online in Iran, and who you can't see since you're a political refugee, you can't go back to Iran, do you feel like that brought you closer to them?
Okay, this is a very deep question, Lisa. What is anxiety during pandemic? It is about the disconnection, losing, and grief. And for me, this is always my like a main issue, having home, connecting with home, feeling safe home. But I didn't know how I can do that. I really wanted to do meaningful things, to feel life in my heart. I'm in connection with my mom, but I asked her to tell me about one of her recipe, exactly the recipe that I am teaching now. And when my mom started to talk about this recipe, my sister came, took the phone and said, okay, I want to show you exactly what is it. And then she took the phone to her kitchen and I suddenly saw all of that pickles and jam. She had a little tour for me about everything. And it's made me my heart, you know, it was like you don't have access to something that you love from your childhood and you can see it. You can see it now. And I felt so much connection and I felt that I want to create that feeling in my home. I can't go back to my country to be with my family, but I can create same food that they are having it now in the same time. So food is not just representing food for me, you know. Food is about the recreating the things that I cannot have it here because of the lack of justice, because I can't come back. So I feel empowered when I am doing the same life that I want to do and I wish to do by food. So food representing for me like a reclaiming the life that I deserve to have it.
Once you started teaching online classes and now that you've been doing it for almost a year, because you started teaching online classes the first week of May, what do you think? What surprised you? What's this been like for you?
You know, I told you that I did activism by digital media. I created this style in Iran when we were in the street. We had just iPhone video. And so for me, concept of citizen journalism by digital and by phone, it's very normal, but it's about the action. Subject is action. But cooking concept, like professionally, when you said we should cook online, I had two challenges. I wanted to give the same feeling of kitchen to people. And it was challenged that how I can do it visually by Zoom. And the second thing was that love, that it is our signature in League of Kitchen. How I can bring love to digital space, you know. I can say now that it is possible because we did it. I feel when I am cooking in my kitchen, other people, even they have different version of this food, they are happy. They have their own experience. And this is very artistic. This is not just cooking. This is art, that we can have same experience with our own abilities in our own kitchen. And also we can share with love and storytelling. And I think this is unique, because it's about another dimension of the life in digital space, that we don't share color and action and music. We are exchanging taste and smell. And that is amazing.
And now you're teaching what you learned online from your mom and grandmother and sisters to your students, which is pretty amazing that it's all happened online.
You know, my mom is around 80s, like maybe 82, and I don't know how long I can have her or I have chance to see her. Maybe never. But she has very unique food and recipe, and I really wanted to make it, to recreate it when she is alive. I asked her about that very delicious meal that we make during Nowruz and Yalda. That is chicken with prune, very, very special sauce with prune and saffron. When I have it, I feel this is my mom food. And that is important.
And I have to say, having made it in your online class, it's a very unique dish with the cumin seed, rose water, saffron, prunes, onions.
Wow, yeah.
With the chicken. It's amazing. And then you're also teaching rice with a potato tadig, which just so beautifully complements it.
You know, they are very good together. You know, I think these two foods, they are really pandemic time food. I couldn't do this in normal time. If I can put it in the history of Persian food, I can say this two dish is pandemic Persian food.
That was League of Kitchens founder Lisa Gross in conversation with cooking instructor Mab Abbaskolizadeh. I can't recommend League of Kitchens classes enough. And we've got a recipe for Mab's mom's Koresh with prunes on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. The story of Spoon by H was the food world equivalent of a Cinderella story. Chef Yunjin Huang opened a tiny dessert shop in 2012 and served a loyal customer base for 6 years, until David Chang shared a photo of her manduguk to his more than 1 million Instagram followers, catapulting this small restaurant to international fame. The press came, the lines followed, and all the while, there was Yunjin in the kitchen, behind the register, on social media responding to comments. She remembers everyone's order, launches new specials, and checks in to see how your meal was. I still marvel at her ability to do it all. But COVID did not spare Spoon by H. In fact, we were scheduled to have Yunjin on this show a few weeks ago, the same week that she made the difficult decision to close. I'm so grateful she's given us her time today. Spoon by H is this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Yunjin Huang, and I'm the owner and chef at Spoon by H in Los Angeles. Spoon by H started as a little dessert cafe. We actually had run two cafes back when we lived in Korea. And so when my family moved to US and decided to start Spoon by H in 2012, we wanted to make Korean-style desserts. We wanted to make shaved ice, pretty custom drinks and teas, and of course, waffles. Spoon by H is still that same dessert cafe, but over time, we expanded our menu to include Korean dishes that we wanted to share with our customers. I was born and raised in Seoul, South Korea. I grew up learning to love all kinds of food. I feel like our love of food and cooking runs in the family because my grandmother actually used to run a restaurant in Korea during war times, and she must have passed something down to my mother. Everyone says there's nothing like eating a mother's home-cooked meal. I think that's one of the feelings I try to put into our food at Spoon by H. Spoon by H and our menu evolved in the same way our relationships and friendship with our customers evolved. We were so lucky to have such a special base of loyal customers grow to become our regulars. We all became very close, and many of them are like family to us. I naturally came to know everyone's usual orders by heart, and I remember what they liked and disliked and their food allergies. Eventually, our regulars started to make special requests. They wanted to try Korean food. So I started cooking for them. I made one dish and then another and another. I knew who loved spicy foods and who didn't, and who could have meat in their bibimbap and who needed to have tofu. I catered to the tastes and needs of each of my customers until suddenly I had developed an entire menu of dishes beyond desserts and shaved ice. Because there are already plenty of traditional Korean restaurants in K-Town, I wanted to give my customers a version of Korean food that might be a little bit different. So our mandukguk, it's not like authentic mandukguk. So some people try it and then they're like, oh, it tastes like clam chowder. Some people like, oh, it looks like, you know, tomka soup, like a coconut based. Or some people says, like, it's tonkotsu ramen base. It's kind of not authentic, but I wanted to make something everyone can eat it, like, every day. Back in 2018, when Roy Lee, a film producer who is one of our regulars, brought Chef David Chang to dine at our restaurant, Chef Chang posted about us to his Instagram, and that's when things started to change. We were so grateful and amazed, but at the same time, it was a lot of pressure. We felt this enormous sense of responsibility to not let down all the people who had come to try our food based on Chef Chang's recommendation. We worried that our new customer would come with such high expectation and that we might disappoint them. We felt an even greater obligation to Chef Chang to not disappoint anyone because he had really personally vouched for us. I put a ton of pressure on myself. I was my own toughest critic. At the same time, it was a dream come true to get to share Korean cuisine with so many people. Every time a non-Korean customer calls our dumpling soup mandukguk and not wonton soup, or when someone makes the effort to pronounce these Korean dishes by their Korean names, kimchi bokkeumbap or kimbap, these moments really kept me going and gave me the strength to want to do this all over again every day. COVID hit us hard in so many ways. We lost business but had to take an extra cost to meet COVID safety requirements. We had to let go of all our staff and scale down our operations. And one of the toughest changes to our business is that last year, we started to see a big increase in customer disputing charges with their credit card companies or requesting refunds through their delivery apps. There were fraudulent claims that they hadn't received their orders or parts of their order when they had. And as a default, they are almost always granted the refunds. So we started to document every order that went out. We took photos of all the food as evidence because this sort of thing became so frequent. But even with photo evidence, it's still almost impossible to successfully dispute these claims. We just felt so incredibly helpless and frustrated. Then as the pandemic went on, it only got worse. A few months back, a customer placed an order, one of the largest orders we've ever had. I helped him shuttle all of the food into his van. He later disputed the charge and we lost over $700, even with photo evidence of the order. Since then, we've been dealing with even more cases like this. There are almost too many to count. We decided to close our doors for many reasons. We lost so much revenue, not only due to slow business, but it was an unbelievable amount just to the fraud and scams alone. I was spending hours every day trying to fight these claims with so many different companies. We just couldn't keep running our business that way, losing money and resources. But really, the biggest reason was that this work was no longer the same work that I had fallen in love with and had always felt so grateful and lucky to do. When taking orders from customers, I found myself feeling wary and suspicious of everyone. I felt myself changing as it became harder to feel that deep sense of gratitude in my heart towards the work that I love to do. And I realized that this is not the way I wanted to run a business, and that I need to step away from this before it really started to affect my health mentally and physically. But when we made an announcement that we would be closing, one of our dealers and oldest customers immediately took action and started GoFundMe page for Spoon by H. And the response was overwhelming. I don't think I can really explain what it means to me to have been so hurt and disappointed by the worst in people, but then at the same time receive an unbelievable amount of comfort and love, grace from the very best in people. I'm grateful for the reminder that there's more good in the world than there is bad. I need to take time to grieve a little bit. It feels like I've let go of these things. I put my whole heart into for over 9 years, like I left my baby behind. I'm not quite ready yet to immediately dive into planning my next steps. But I do want to say to everyone who sent us so much love and generosity, when I have had chance to recharge and get back on my feet, I hope there will be an opportunity to repay you all for the grace you've shown us. Because I truly do love this work with all of my heart.
That was Yunjin Huang. Her beloved Spoon by H may be closed for now, but I can't wait to see what she does next. In a minute, a party van complete with a karaoke setup and Christmas lights distributes PPE and food aid to essential workers in the Central Valley. We have that story when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Hunger. People in Southern California experienced it at too high a rate before the pandemic struck. But with so many un- or underemployed having to choose between food and rent, even more of our neighbors continue to struggle to put enough food on the table. Michael Flood is the man who has watched food insecurity play out in Southern California for years. He's the executive director of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank, and he joins us with a reflection on the past year.
So prior to the pandemic, the LA Regional Food Bank was partnering with 600 other organizations, food pantries, soup kitchen and meal programs, older adult children's programs throughout Los Angeles County. And I would say the biggest issue at that time was our area's high housing costs and how that was putting a lot of pressure on household budgets. Unfortunately, forcing some people into losing their housing. But for those that are continuing to hold on to their housing, really struggling between paying the rent and other basic expenses and paying for food. And since the pandemic hit, really the story is unemployment and people who have been thrown out of work, laid off, furloughed, or had maybe hours cut back severely, and the pressure that has put on so many more households than we were seeing needing food assistance prior to the pandemic. And a lot of people brand new to need. We've heard this over and over again at some of our larger drive-through distributions, people telling us this is the first time they've ever had to seek food assistance in their lives. They were doing fine, but when the COVID-19 situation hit, and parts of the economy started closing down, it pushed them in a situation of needing food assistance really overnight. Prior to the pandemic, the food bank runs what's called a mobile food pantry program, and we move those distributions around to community colleges, health clinics, community sites throughout Los Angeles County. And we saw in mid-March with some initial distributions, the lines streaming many blocks. At that point, people on foot seeking food assistance, and we would have to dispatch truck after truck to try to just serve everyone who was in line. And we quickly decided, let's move a lot of these distributions to drive-through distributions for those that have a vehicle. For those that don't have a vehicle, they continue to go to a food pantry or other partner to get food assistance. So we saw that starting right in mid-March, and it has not abated in the year that's followed. People start lining up early. I remember prior to the end of the year holidays where we had a distribution at Santa Monica Airport, and the cars started lining up at 6:30 in the morning for a 9 a.m. distribution. Even though we had plenty of food, it, you know, just families really worried about getting that food assistance for themselves. I remember one of the reporters who was there interviewed the Villegas family, who was first in line. And they had started to line up at 6:30 in the morning for this 9 a.m. distribution. And when asked in terms of what their situation was, both the husband and wife had worked in the hospitality industry and then laid off since March. And they had been recycling cans to try to provide a little bit of income for themselves, but really have been struggling with, again, you know, unemployment benefits and any other way they could get help. And I think what struck all of us was this was food for their Christmas dinner, to celebrate their Christmas dinner. They were out of food, and this was the difference for them in terms of eating that day and the next day and through the holidays. And we see this from so many, again, families and individuals coming through where they're out of food, and this is it. And this food assistance is really essential and critical. The three best ways for people to help are to volunteer, to donate, and to advocate. Volunteering at the food bank or one of our partner agency sites is very basic work. You know, we ask for people who are not dealing with the COVID situation or not in threat of underlying health conditions to think about volunteering their time. People can donate financially, both to the food bank and to our agency partners. Because we rely so heavily on donated food, for every dollar that's donated, the food bank's able to distribute the equivalent of four meals. And advocacy is a really important part of our work. You know, what is happening in Washington, D.C., Sacramento, and locally, those decisions that are made have a huge impact on the families and people, workers, small businesses, to turn things around. You know, the food bank lends its voice and advocates for policies that are going to help residents here in Los Angeles County not just deal with food issues, but really be able to turn things around, because so many people have lost everything. We have a lot of people who've gone through their entire life savings. They've worked their entire lives. They're towards the end of their working career, and this has completely upended their financial life. They have nothing left. And I think it just, again, speaks to that overall issue that this is something that we can all do something about, right? Let's do what we can. Let's make it an opportunity so that we can come out of this in many ways, not weaker and more fragmented, but stronger in providing the kind of help and assistance and opportunity that we all want individually and that we should hope for others.
That was Michael Flood, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. One of the cruelest places where hunger manifests is in the agricultural fields. It's unconscionable that the men and women who pick our crops are food insecure. Yet the pandemic has laid bare the brutal realities of life as an essential worker. Those who pick our crops are the most essential and the most vulnerable. For 7 years, Ricardo Castorena has been coordinating resources to California farm workers through his organization, Binacional of Central California. But when the pandemic hit, his life and his work took an unexpected turn. Known as El Profe, Castorena now drives a funfetti-colored party van to the fields, armed with masks and other essential supplies. He has put 25,000 miles on the odometer since last March and joins us today to tell us about El Profe's wild ride.
I got my nickname from my students. I was a teacher for 20 years in adult education. And in Mexico, you call your teacher Profe. So my nickname has been part of my life for about 20 years. I've been known as El Profe in the community, especially with my students. So they're the ones that baptized me with that name. In adult education, a large number of your students, or in this particular case, my students, were farm workers. And about 10, 15 years ago, I realized that my students didn't really have even the essentials, notebooks, paper, pencils, even backpacks in some cases. So obviously, we started to try to help them out, myself and a committee of friends. And that sort of snowballed to creating a committee that would go out to the fields to provide these services on a small scale, of course. And then the pandemic hit, and I needed to figure out a way to get these services out to the community. We have the typical white nonprofit van that everybody's used to seeing. Almost looks like a cross between a church van and a police officer's van. So it was just intimidating. And I just, lo and behold, ran into the van situation where Radio Láser was looking for access to continue to promote itself during the pandemic. Not a lot of ideas were out there. And I thought, there's no better place to promote yourself than in the fields. And I need to get to the fields. So it was like a partnership made in heaven. The moment I started to use the Radio Láser van, which is called La Regalona, and if you translate it, it's called the gift. And it was like night and day. People could not wait to see me come versus who is that guy? So it was definitely a game changer for me. My focus, our mission and our vision is to serve farm workers and their families, which has now extended into low-income families. I drive anywhere from Bakersfield to Modesto on any given day. So my focus is really to help as many farm workers as possible understand COVID and how it can be destructive, but how you can maintain yourself safe through social distancing, wearing a mask, and then, of course, covering some desperate needs, which is food. We can provide food for them as well. Farm work is great work if you're good at it, but you can't really sustain a lifestyle from it. The income that you can make is not for a family of three or four or five, for example. So let's just say I walk out the door and I go to the movies or I buy groceries. How much did I spend? And the average rent, even locally in our area, is about $1,000 to $1,500, but you only made that for the entire month. So where does the milk come from? Where do the eggs come from? So these folks, which work outrageous hours, 6 to 7 days a week, especially during busy season, are making less than most people, but are providing more than anyone else. When you see an amazing, beautiful apple on your table, you don't realize that someone who's barely making it by picked that for you. And that's what we've been trying to preach. Just because you're working doesn't mean that you're making enough to survive. So a typical day for La Regalona, aka The Gift, we drive to a different part of the county, especially in Fresno, which is the first area of the county we stop in. And we stop in a field where we already have an appointment because we've made a connection with the foreman or the farmer or farm workers. And they can just hear the music blasting what feels like from a mile away. Probably the most fun I have is the moment I drive up to a field and I start bumping Selena. Everyone in the world, no matter what language you speak, knows who Selena is. And I don't think you can get much more joy out of life than watching someone pick crop, but then goes into full dance mode as if you just were transported into a nightclub or their favorite restaurant where they do karaoke, and watching like 50, 60 people sing Selena's song is truly inspirational. I'm telling you, it's, if you were to walk into that field when I show up and they start dancing and singing, you would not know that any of these folks are struggling. That's how much joy music brings to them. And we start talking. We say, hi. We say, how are you? How's your mom? How's your dad? How are the kids? We stay away from the major conversation, which is COVID, and we focus on those small things, right? Like, did you have a good cup of coffee? Here's a donut. Here's a pan dulce. What do you need? And then we get to that conversation. One of the things that I learned is that they just want someone to talk to. They just want someone to tell, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I think. This is what doesn't happen for me. This is what does happen for me. And then, of course, eventually we do get to the reason why I'm there is to help them protect themselves from COVID, whether through social distancing or wearing a mask or protecting their children. But the most important part now for me is advocating for that vaccine. I need to make sure that they get that vaccine, that their children get the vaccine, that their mom, their grandma, everyone gets the vaccine so we can be a little more protected. One of the things I can tell you, when I started to go out, I was almost shocked to see teachers, doctors from Mexico. I've seen professionals, people that sell insurance, people that were working in the fast food industry, people that had a typical office job in the fields, because there aren't very many jobs, or there weren't very many jobs, especially when the pandemic really kicked off. You know, I have a job. I don't even call it a job. It's like I have a life where you have to make people smile even while you feel the sadness and the pain that they're feeling, which is really the toughest part of my job, but it is the part that I enjoy. It's become important to me to advocate in a way where I advocate differently for each person based on what I have in front of me. So yes, for some people I say, good morning, would you like a cup of coffee? And to others, I start with a corny joke. And to others, I just start singing. By the way, I cannot sing. So that obviously that creates some form of laughter. And to others, I just work alongside them for about half an hour until they say hi. And then I get these messages sometimes at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. Hey, I don't have milk and eggs. Can you help me? And it's painful to hear, but at the same time, you feel full of hope, right? Because they were able to pick up their phone and know that they could text you. And believe me, when someone is asking you for milk and eggs and not for groceries, there's a huge difference in that question. That if you're asking for milk and eggs, that means you have nothing. You have very little. You know, and it's obviously, it becomes a priority to us to be able to provide that service for people. It is extremely important to build trust, especially with a community that's used to being let down quite often, right? So I can tell you that the misconception is that they want money and they don't. What they want is a fair shot, just to be on a playing field where everyone is equal. And if they are putting food on our table, then they should be compensated for that. But not in the sense that they're getting paid an enormous amount of money, more rather they're considered part of what is important in California, especially in California or states where ag is important. And I think what they want to be known for is a productive part of our society versus the last ones on the totem pole.
That's Ricardo Castorena, better known as El Profe. His organization, Binacional of Central California, has been able to reach more than 70,000 essential farm workers in California's Central Valley with the help of Radio Lazar's party van. Coming up, we asked farmers at the local farmers market how they would sum up the last year in one word. Their answers after the break. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. In March of 2020, there were a few canary in the coal mine moments for Good Food. The farmers market sticks out as one of them. In early March, bean sales were up. people were hoarding meat, and the energy on Arizona Avenue on Wednesday mornings was heavy, panicked even. It was clear that everything was about to change, but no one knew how, least of all the farmers. For this week's market report, we asked farmers to reflect on the craziest year of our lives.
Hi, my name is Leticia Garcia from Garcia Organic Farm. We're located in Fallbrook, San Diego County. If I can describe in one word last year, I'd have to say panic. Every time I came home from the market, I'd go home panicking, thinking that I had the virus. Because I have three young girls. I have a 13-year-old, 9-year-old, and 7-year-old that I would go home to. And I'd just be scared to be contagious and expose them. So I remember when I had my first customer telling me they were back from recovering from the COVID. And I panicked. I just thought, oh my God, this is the first person that I've been exposed to somebody that has had the disease. And I panicked. I thought I didn't want to hold his money. I kind of wanted him to leave. And I had to step out and like breathe and just say, it's going to be okay.
Alex Weiser from Weiser Family Farms. If I can sum up this year in one word, it would be like it's been a heavy, heavy duty year in many ways and challenging. We've been farming for over 40 years, doing farmers markets since 1981, and this has been the craziest year of them all. You know, farming's gambling. You know, you plant a crop, you hope you're going to grow it well and it's going to find a home. We try to control as many things as we can, but one thing is that we don't know where our society is going to be. But I'm banking on it's going to be a roaring 20s, and people are going to even more want to be at restaurants, and people are going to even more want to have more melons and eat together. So you strategize in your head, how is it going to be 3 months from now, 6 months from now? As a grower, you're always, okay, 6 months from now. So we're growing more. We're going bigger on melons, and it's a gamble, as farming is. I've learned this year that human beings are definitely social animals. It's just, we don't come to the farmer's market just to buy our food and nourish ourselves. It's to see our neighbors, our friends, our farmers, our community, and it's just so much more apparent that that's part of what we live for, is being around each other.
This is Megan Strom, and I am co-owner at County Line Harvest. I would say that the entire last year has just been a roller coaster, and it continues to be. Not that that's all that different from farming in general. You know, we put everything on the line every single fall when we start up our season, not knowing that we will make back, you know, all of the investment that we put into the field. It really has all just been a blur, but I can remember back to, you know, Tuesday, March 10th, we had our first distributor order canceled on us. And later that afternoon, we had another one canceled. And that's when I really knew, like, things were going to change and we needed to do something about it. And things happened really, really quickly from there. And a big part of that is thanks to you, is you reached out and asked if you could interview us about how Corona was starting to affect us. And I just knew that with the opportunity to get my voice on the radio and potentially launch a new program, I needed to move really, really quickly. So, you know, that whole week of interviewing with you on Wednesday, and then I had 3 days to get things live for our CSA program so that by Saturday, when the interview aired, all the information would be up on our website. And then the following week after we launched, the community support was so phenomenal. I can remember sitting at my computer and watching orders for the CSA roll in almost one a second. And I had tears in my eyes, and it felt like the end of It's a Wonderful Life. Like, it was, not that I thought that everything was going to be okay forever, but I knew that we could at least, you know, get the crew back in the field, start harvesting again, and continue on with business.
My name is Romeo Coleman. I run Coleman Family Farms in Carpinteria and Ventura area, and come down to Santa Monica twice a week, Wednesday and Saturday in Santa Monica. It's been very challenging. You're trying to plan for something you don't know about and what to expect. It's like I'm a wild animal being stalked by a prey and trying to get along and stay alive. And the prey is constantly moving where it is, and I have to get to a safe spot and try and keep going and stay alive. Business has changed for us because we sell a lot of product to restaurants, so that really shut down at the beginning. And but I was happily surprised by the support of the farmers market and how the city of Santa Monica was able to keep it open. And the customers that came out and waited in line and came to the market were here to buy produce, and they did buy produce. They're not messing around, so it's great. Okay.
Hi, my name is Sherry Mandel from Tehachapi Grain Project. I grow heritage grain and sell flour and now tortillas. Anecdotally, I guess, I would say that chefs and farmers are a strong breed. They understand hard work and they understand making the most of what you have. So I've seen a lot of resiliency. The other really cool thing that's happened during the pandemic is that we've been able to barter. So between farmers and between chefs, I will barter my tortillas or flour for actual, you know, ready-made food, pies, cakes. Today, Sarifa brought me lentils and rice in trade for tortillas. I trade at Farmer's Market for skirt steak with Autonomy Farms, mushrooms and garden of lettuces, beans from Two Peas in a Pod, and it's just a really beautiful dynamic that money no longer is the superpower with us. It's our food.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Lara Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and John Meek. I'm Evan Kleinman. Thank you for listening this week and every week. It is a tremendous privilege to share stories with you. I'll be back in 1 week with an all-new episode of Good Food.